We'll call the Committee of Education Policy together. We have a unique situation today. We thank Chair Davini for letting us use his time slot with us having to end at noon today. We got bumped, and we had a really good program set up for folks to hear about the trauma-informed education work that District 287 is doing, to have a brief discussion about the book we read this summer, and then have an informational hearing from Representative Moran on her trauma-informed bill that's actually in Ed Finance. So we'll have members moving in and out because they're in other committees, but I wanted us to get started. So why don't we have Dr. Sandra Lewandowski, the superintendent from 287, come forward. Intermediate School District 287 is based in Plymouth, but is a consortium of 11 metro school districts working collaboratively to provide smaller learning environments to students who demonstrate significant, multiple, and complex needs. So they have been working with Child Trauma Academy, that works to improve the lives of high-risk children by improving systems that educate, nurture, and protect these kiddos. So we have you here today, and if you could just state your name for the record and proceed, and you have go walk through your presentation.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for having us here today. My school district serves about 1,000 of the highest need students in Hennepin County, with almost all of the students having multiple trauma episodes in their life. Even for a school district that's experienced in the education of students who have childhood trauma and mental illness, we have a very high incidence of safety in our district, as you'll see in the graphic in your packet and up on the screen. Such incidents include threats to commit suicide, destruction of property, suicide ideation and attempts, threats to bring weapons to school, acute mental health crises requiring ambulance transport, and not surprisingly, such incidents result in over 300 staff getting injured every year in our district. The state and national trauma statistics tell the story behind these incidents. More than half of our Minnesota children have experienced childhood trauma. The graphic entitled "The Pair of ACEs" shows the individual and community traumas a student might experience. The numbers are even graver when you account for race. More than twice as many black children experience trauma compared to their white peers. 1 in 4 young people report having long-term mental health, behavioral, or emotional issues. According to the Minnesota Department of Health, these children are 5 times more likely to commit suicide. And according to a recent congressional report, the suicide rate for black youth is rising faster than any other racial and ethnic group, now making it the second leading cause of death for black children aged 10 to 19. Some research suggests that 80% of such students do not receive help. And I think it might be hard for committee members to grasp the magnitude of the problem, not just in my school district, but with all school districts in Minnesota. In the words of Dr. Robert Block, the former president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences, are the single greatest unaddressed public health threat facing our nation today. It's because of these statistics we'd like to share with you several things today that are bulleted on the next slide. And the neuroscience of the brain is the first one, explaining why it's important for educators to become knowledgeable about trauma, describing trauma-informed and healing-centered approaches, hear the experience of a principal involved in the trauma-informed mental health program, and finally, what we might suggest to you to further this critical work. I'm going to let Mr. Greener talk at this point.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Steve Greener. I am the project director for the Neurosequential Model in Education. So I work with Dr. Bruce Perry and his Neurosequential Model Network. And thank you for having me and be a part of this testimony. I think in order to understand how trauma affects the behavior and the learning abilities of our kids and our staff members, we need to understand a little bit about healthy brain development. So I invite you to look at the upside down pyramid. And at the base of our brain is a brain stem. It's attached to the spinal cord. The first part of our brain to grow and to develop, it even starts to organize and develop in utero, with mom's heartbeat being the regulating rhythm, and we experience this this crucial portal as it helps us mature and monitor our respiration, our blood pressure, our heart rate, all the survival systems of the body. So when you think of the brainstem, think of that survival part of our brain that we all need to have regulated. And it is the most reactive part of our brain. One level higher in the yellow level is the diencephalon, which monitors things like appetite and sleep and balance and rhythm. It's the functions it mediates are more complex. We get a good idea that how important sleep and diet and exercise are to the brain developments of us and of our children. The limbic system is next, the green portion of that figure. And the limbic system is physically the smallest part of our brains, but it's extra powerful because it mediates our relational lives and it's our emotional center. And finally, we get to the top of the brain, the part that all of us educators or former educators understand is the cortex, which we have always targeted in our work. It is the learning center of our brains. It's the biggest, the most complex, the most easily changed part of our brain. And when it's healthy, it has the ability to regulate those lower portions of the brain that I've already spoken about. It gives us a chance, a well-developed cortex gives us a chance to enjoy executive function and that sense of self-control that we want for all of our children. So if all of these regions are healthy and they're well-developed and working in coordination, we experience flow, that beautiful feeling in life when things are just going well. That's a healthy brain. But the second slide, the one below it, and it's a busy slide, so I don't think you'll need to look at all the details, but I invite you to look in particular at the line that talks about state. And the whole idea that we function in this world in a state-dependent way. So when our and the five states that we teach are, first of all, the calm state. And when we feel safe and secure in who we are, we can turn short-term memory into long-term memory. It's the part of our brain that lets us create new things out of what we already know. And as I said, we feel safe and secure in the calm state. The next state of our brain is an alert state, which is now involving stress becoming more, we become more aware of stressors that come with new learning. We feel safe. We can still think pretty well in the alert state. And actually, it's the best learning state for our kids. To have a little bit of stress, something new is coming, something novel is coming, and it is the part of our brain that helps us learn new things. However, when stressors become greater than what we can handle in a calm or alert manner, we end up in the alarm state, and we feel the stress in a stronger way, no longer feeling safe. Thinking parts of our brain are now compromised, and we become more fearful and more reactive. If we get into the fear state, we are definitely feeling unsafe. No learning is possible. No good communication is possible. We start to have a hard time telling time. And we get that feeling of fight or flight that we all recognize. And finally, if our kids or we are ever in a terror state, we are on autopilot. Our brainstem takes over. We have little or no memory. We're hugely reactive. And we may do negative behaviors we don't even remember. So stress that is manageable becomes a positive force for learning. We need it. As long as we can be in a calm state or an alert state, we can learn well and function well in school, both in learning and in behavior. However, when we have kids suffering from all kinds of adversity, we have kids come to us in the alarm or fear state. They're desperately in need of regulation in a safe, supportive environment. And with the effort to regulate these kids, we give them a chance to use the better learning parts of their brain. So clearly we all want the same thing. We want better behavior and we want better learning. We all want that. But what we need to learn together is how best to train the whole brain. Understanding the sequential nature of our brains, and we work for that wonderful flow that we want for our teachers and for our learners so that they can thrive. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Steve has described the neuroscience that makes it imperative that educators understand brain function as it relates to behavior and achievement. Additionally, with the safety incidents we experience in our school district, we felt it was so imperative that we learn more about trauma-informed practices because we simply believed we couldn't sustain the status quo of the injuries and incidents that we were experiencing. We felt something needed to change if we were going to successfully serve these high-need students within the public school realm. And because preparation programs for education and educators and education assistants do not prepare us to understand trauma, we often fail to work in a way that is based on this neuroscience you just heard. Why is it so important? Well, Dr. Ann Garrity is a renowned local expert in childhood trauma. She suggests without a baseline understanding of trauma in the brain, well-meaning staff can keep perpetuating the reactivity of our students. They don't adequately understand the trauma our students have experienced and how that translates into anxiety and reactivity when they are frightened. It isn't the kids that acting out and we respond, but rather it's that we sometimes frighten the kids, albeit unintentionally, and they react physiologically and with their behavior. A superintendent of mine recently relayed the story of a fifth grader in one of their classrooms who was under a lot of stress because of some things happening at home. His very well-meaning teacher went up to him to give him a hug and comfort him, and the neuroscience played out. He was not in the place in his brain where he could accept the hug, and he punched her in the eye, and the entire class watched another trauma play out in front of them. Increasingly, we understand that students who have trauma and are triggered cannot focus on learning. Dr. Bruce Perry suggests neurobiological stress is the mechanism of low achievement and mental illness. Given the incredible achievement gap we experience in Minnesota, one might speculate that some part of our achievement issues might well be related to childhood trauma and how we as educators react to that trauma. Using an understanding of the brain leads us to leverage our incredible use of relationships as educators, as well as other strategies like rhythm and sensory experiences in order to heal and learn. As Dr. Perry would say, relationships are the agent of change and the most powerful therapy is human love. And instead of asking what's wrong with that child, we should be asking what happened to that child, and then as educators, adjust accordingly. So what does it mean to be a trauma-informed school? I've included a couple of infographics that talks about that kind of experience, as well as some real detail behind it. I can say for our district, it's certainly not a one-size-fits-all. Some schools are going to approach us somewhat differently than we are because of the high level of need in our student population. It also means that we have to be very careful that our staff are well-trained and are able to understand at least this basic neuroscience that Steve talked about, and not inadvertently trigger the kids. That is one of the biggest things we've learned and are trying to share with our staff, is how you react, even if it's well-meaning, might not be the best reaction for a particular situation. And so for us to implement trauma-informed practices, we've begun a 3-year implementation plan to become certified with Child Trauma Organization of Dr. Perry's. We're in the first year, and we're training 46 of our staff as trauma coaches, if you will. One key learning is that a dysregulated adult cannot regulate a dysregulated child. And so another graphic that shows some of parts of the responses you might have as an educator, I'm not going to go into it, but I think it's really interesting because you have to consciously think to regulate yourself, even with you're in an experience where a child may be cursing at you, he may be threatening you, you have to not escalate in order to calm him down, and that takes some pretty significant skill for an educator to do well. The training we're experiencing will supplement other things we've done over the past couple of years, and I'd like to share just a few of those. We know that our educators make all the difference in the lives of our children, and thousands of healing, therapeutic moments are provided for children each week if we can have a regulated, respected faculty, and that can be key to a child's healing of their trauma. We need to make sure our staff are as healthy as possible in order to make sure that they can be fully present for our children. So in our district, we have a major strategic priority to support employee well-being. And the next graphic shows multiple parts of our particular efforts, but it's good that we want our employees to have a solid and a stable well-being state of mind. It's even more important for the kids that the staff have it. And so we're trying to really, again, strategically support that staff well-being. We've made a decision to switch from school resource officers to school safety coaches, and we now have a diverse pool of safety coaches who have skills in de-escalating students and their ability to build strong relationships with them. In other words, we wanted to treat mental health in a way that doesn't criminalize their trauma and potentially their mental illness. As a result, our restrictive procedures are down, and our school safety coaches have been able to resolve about 95% of our student crises without the need for police intervention. We've established a district mobile response team who, among other things, helps to talk with staff after an incident to emotionally support them. The staff also participate in meetings afterwards, reviewing the incident to plan what we might do differently the next time. Another critically important reflection time. And we use restorative practices extensively and try to keep our staff trained on this non-disciplinary approach. Finally, with the use of a recent 2-year innovative mental health grant that's ending in June, we've implemented a significant partnership with the Amherst Wilder Foundation to do a therapeutic teaching program that's located at one of our buildings. And I'd like to now introduce Tanya Allen, the principal of that building, to explain the program.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tanya Allen, and I'm a principal at North Education Center. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. I'm here to advocate based on my experiences as a principal. As you have heard, District 287 serves students with some of the highest needs within Hennepin County. I've received training through attending the Neurosequential Model in Education program. The training provided me with 2 full days of training with Dr. Perry, Steve Grainer, and other members of their team. In addition, I gained access to materials to further my knowledge of their model. The training has allowed additional administrators and mental health staff in my building and throughout the district to work to become trauma-informed, to better support teachers and education assistants in our schools. Imagine being a 10-year-old child who lived in a single-parent household. Your mother did her best, but was abused by your father, who was a drug addict until he was sent to prison. Your mom worked 2 jobs, which placed you in the care of an aunt whose boyfriend eventually sexually assaulted you multiple times. You never spoke about the abuse. As you could see, your mom was struggling. You felt ashamed and embarrassed, but were determined to be the best you could be. Fast forward 15 years, and you are now a 25-year-old mother of a 7-year-old child. You graduated high school, but had your son right after, and have been working a retail job to support your family, which has caused you to be homeless a few times due to low pay. Your son's father is in and out of the home. He is not physically abusive, but verbally abusive towards you, and he says you will never be anything, and you believe it. As a parent, you're trying to make sure all is well, but your son has been struggling in school since preschool. Because of working nights, your son is worried because of having multiple caregivers and anxious, so he struggles to sleep at night. At school, he is unable to concentrate on what his teacher is teaching him, and schoolwork is frustrating for him. He was assessed for special education, and you're trying to navigate this world that you do not completely understand. This is the type of profile of the families that we impact through the therapeutic teaching model at North Education Center. As a result of the NME training, I've been able to personally lead training around trauma as well as the intersection of race and trauma within my school to over 50 staff. In addition, our mental health staff have provided support to staff around self-care as teachers and education assistants work to help co-regulate students each day. Mental health staff work to prevent compassion fatigue and secondary trauma for staff working with students who have endured various forms of traumatic experiences in their lives. By far, the greatest impact of the financial assistance has been the effect of children in our school. During the past year and a half of implementing the therapeutic teaching model through the Innovative Mental Health Grant, we've been able to support students with learning coping strategies and skills, as well as help them to identify their feelings. We have students who were previously physically acting out daily that are learning through repetition and knowledge of how the brain works, what it means to verbally express their emotions. Our families who have had barriers to access to resources and emotional support are able to engage in family therapy to continue what is happening in the classroom on a daily basis, beginning to occur at home. In education, we often focus on test scores and how much academic progress students have made. Yet we cannot underestimate the significance of the importance of social and emotional learning being embedded into programming daily for students. This grant has allowed a partnership with the Amherst Wilder Foundation, and it has allowed us to have licensed therapists within the classroom providing mental health support to students in real time, as well as family therapists who regularly work with parents in their homes. Dr. Bruce Perry shared during our training that 45 minutes of therapy one time per week is not an effective therapeutic model. However, that is what many of our students would be able to access if they didn't have barriers such as transportation or lack of appropriate insurance. We know as a system that we need to be aware of the impact trauma not only on our students, but also their parents and their community. The investment that has been made is paying off in early results. We do not use a single measure to determine success, but we consider the numbers of restrictive procedures, attendance, behavior incidents, as well as reading and math scores. Our early results are demonstrating that students are making academic gains from when they started our program to now, and behavior incidents are less intense and occurring less frequently. A success story is the reality of us beginning to discuss students that are close to returning to their home school districts. We believe this level of early intervention has made this possible for our students. Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, I stated earlier that committee members might have difficulty grasping the magnitude of the impact of trauma on today's youth. We recently put together a 3-minute video that highlights the magnitude that we do understand in our district, because we've come to understand a lot more about trauma, and we understand that racism is a form of trauma. And so this video intersects the two of them, and I invite you to watch it now.
Little technical difficulties will be just a minute. Members, after this and when the presentation's done, I want to open it up for questions for anybody on the panel, and then especially if you want to discuss the book as well.
As superintendent, I see the impact of racism and trauma every single day in our district.
She would know.
I feel bad.
She would know how to fix it.
There we go.
Oh, there we go.
Give it time. Now I'm worried because she's taking forever. Cell phone might be lost.
As superintendent, I see the impact of racism and trauma every single day in our district. A black student is 6 times more likely to end up in corrections rather than mental health treatment. What we know is our systems and policies have failed our most vulnerable youth over and over. For some students in my school district, we are the last stop on the pipeline to prison. If we're going to end that trajectory, we have to start mental health treatment, culturally appropriate mental health treatment, much earlier on.
He was a kid who I feel like slipped through the cracks. I would say he was a very intelligent young man. He did graduate. I would say not even 6 months later, he's still interacting with a lot of the young people that he dealt with, the streets and the gangs, of course. And a tragic incident occurred. He was manipulated to an outcome that cost him his life, but also the life of another elder of the community. As a community, we failed them. We failed them because we don't give them the mental health support that they need.
If you're chronically stressed, if your system already is worked up and worried all the time, you're always looking, you're always prepared to run or to fight something off, which means you can't look at the board, you're kind of paying attention all the time, you're always hearing something, you're checking in the back of you, you're not able to be present. To understand when they're tapping or they're starting to get anxious about something or they turn to another kid, that redirection, the narration about you're looking nervous or you're looking worried, not only does a therapist do it, but now the teachers do. It's a therapeutic teaching model.
Comparing and contrasting classrooms where we have therapeutic support and where we don't, students are able to stay in the classroom much longer. That means that they're able to make it through reading. They're able to make it through math. They're able to work on all those academic skills that are just as important as those behavioral skills for them to be able to go back to their home schools and be in a less restrictive setting. So that's our goal.
We fail some kids in our school district. And that means those kids may go to jail for life. It means they might die. And as a superintendent, that's hard to live with. But I also know if we can provide our students and their families a culturally appropriate therapeutic program early on, their lives can be much different. They can thrive, they can graduate from high school, they can get a job, and live the lives we all want to live.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you. Did you have more to your presentation?
No.
Mr. Grainer, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I'll do it as a question.
Great. Members, I want to open this up to questions for folks and also include the education finance members if they'd like to represent Sandell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Allen, you described circumstances under which a child might grow up, and of course, they're dramatic and heartbreaking, but where are the services that communities, nonprofit organizations, counties, and the state might be able to provide for the child who's having difficulty in the last couple of years of high school, may become pregnant, prenatal, postnatal care, protection from abuse, all the issues that you describe? Are those services available, and why is it that it's so infrequent that people access them and can be helped by them?
Principal Allen.
Thank you. I would say that that's a complicated issue, but I can give you an example. We try to keep the profiles generic to some extent, but these are real situations. As I mentioned with meeting with Hennepin County representatives, I can tell you as a principal, there was a day that will never leave my memory of a student similar to this profile who I was told by Hennepin County, our school ends at 320. I stayed there with two other staff until 6:30 p.m. with a student who experienced a huge amount of anxiety. And the county's response during this time was that it is our responsibility to maintain those children until their parents come in. Hennepin County Child Protection did not open a case on this particular incident, even though the student was here at school 3 hours past when he should have been. And so I think that, yes, there are lots of nonprofit organizations whose budgets are often cut. There's the county that tries to take responsibility for a lot of cases, but there are cases that fall through the cracks with some of our homeless families. One of the things that we've experienced is that because they're homeless, they're between multiple counties, so then no county is really taking responsibility. So we're talking about a lot of kids and families that are falling through the nets, the safety nets that we all think are there. They're not all there for every family. And I filed reports. I have multiple staff that file reports. I would say Hennepin Child Protection is probably at my building once a week, if not more often. So it isn't that those agencies and entities don't exist. I think the need is exceeding, and I think that because of system failures, we're not serving our children and families the way we think we're serving our children and families. And that's, I think, what then needs to be addressed is then how do we really help support children the best way we know how, given what we're able to do within a school system. So I know that doesn't answer everything about your question, but.
Thank you. Just a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Representative.
Thanks. That's a really good answer. Dr. Lewandowski, are we making any progress toward that? And a number of us are concerned about linking social services to schools so those services are more accessible and easily understood. Can you suggest or have you been working toward a process that would make those services more available and meet the needs of individual children more frequently and better?
Go ahead, Superintendent Lewandowski.
Madam Chair, Representative, I've been in this business the last 15 years as superintendent. I have worked as hard as I know how to work with other community agencies, and including the county and insurance companies. I can tell you the barriers to making that happen on a day-to-day basis in our buildings is nearly impossible. It would take me a dozen people just working on trying to integrate those systems and entities to get even a minimal level of service to our kids in a way that's integrated for the schools. It's my belief we have come to a point in time where we have to intentionally blend those services. We have to figure out how to get the reimbursement rates from insurance companies. And if we can't get those reimbursement rates to work, we have to do programs like this innovative mental health system, where we've essentially created a unit that functions as a mental health provider, a county, and a school system.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you
very much.
Representative Funagan.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, thanks for your presentation, and I empathize with you in the situations that you're working with. I know most people know this, but I did do 13 years of jail ministry, and then after that I did 16 years on the school board, and now I'm 10 years up here at the legislature. I must like disagreement, I decided, but anyway. I do think there's several other factors that contribute to this, and I'd just like you to comment on that. I'll make a few comments. First, several years, I own an independent insurance agency, and I had a young lady come into my office who needed health insurance. So I gave her a quote, and she was looking for a full-time job, so she just needed health insurance until she was working part-time. So I gave her a quote. I said, can you afford that? She said, I can't really afford that. I said, well, maybe you need to go up to social services here and look for Minnesota Care or Medicaid that you could sign up on until you find a full-time job. She said, well, I did that, but they said I don't qualify. And then she added, she said, they told me that if I have a child out of wedlock, they could sign me up for all kinds of benefits, okay? So, you know, and this wasn't in the metro area. This was in a rural county where I have my insurance agency. So I do think there's government programs that actually promote the idea of having children out of wedlock, including our welfare program. You know, just a couple other statistics. You know, prior to the welfare program, 20% of black children were born out of wedlock. Today, the last statistic I had, over 74% of black children are born out of wedlock. There was a study a few years ago, it was on Bring Me the News, that 90% of children living in poverty would be out of poverty if they were in a two-parent family. And yet government programs tend to undermine that.
Representative Grunhagen, yep. Is there a question in there?
Yep, I did. I'd like them to comment on this. So there's some structural things that are actually contributing to the children that are coming into your school. You add Kinsey and Hugh Hefner-based sex ed, you add whole language instead of intensive systematic phonics where the kids can't read, and after 13 years of jail ministry.
Again, I'm giving you a lot of latitude. Could you
I know you
question,
are. Thank
please?
You. Well, we want to get to the solution of these problems, okay? You know, teaching whole language rather than intensive systematic phonics, because when I did jail ministry, guess what most of them couldn't do? They couldn't read. There was a lot of minorities in there, and a lot of them had high school graduation. So we've got some structural things that I think have a taint of racism to them that are based on the government that are causing a lot of these problems. So do you see that also as part of the solution? Thank you.
Superintendent Lewandowski.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in my decades-long service to special education, I have never experienced a family who wanted to do something to be in the kinds of conditions we see families and kids coming to us. Never. I do see a multitude of opportunities to intersect our government entities in a way that are more streamlined and based on the needs of our families and our kids. That's a monumental task, but I do believe we could be more efficient with our public resources. We could make the barriers reduced for our families, and in my experience, that's where the solutions lie rather than blaming the victim.
Thank you. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendent, I just want to thank you for your work. As a therapist, worked at a day treatment facility at Washburn Center for Children. And watching the dysregulation of the kids, knowing what was happening in some of their homes, was heartbreaking. It's such hard work, and I think that we only see things through their own lens. We can't know what it's like to go home for that kid who was at school 3 hours after. What did you do? I guess I'm curious. You said Child Protection didn't open a case. Did you work with that family? Are you doing a lot of work with families in addition to the students? Because to your point, Superintendent, it's not about these kids getting A's and B's at school and whether or not they're going to go to Harvard. It's whether or not you're going to keep them out of the criminal justice system. And what does that look like? And I know that you guys do a very different approach because you're thinking about that. But I guess I'm just curious, what was the follow-up and how much work are you doing with families? Because teachers can't fix everything at school if the kids go home and you have all these different problems. That's, yes, so thank you.
Principal Allen or Superintendent Lewandowski?
Yes, thank you. I would say that we did do a lot of follow-up, and had that student, to be honest, not been in the therapeutic teaching model program, the follow-up would have looked very different. Having that partnership with Wilder Foundation allowed the Wilder therapist then to do follow-up, and the Wilder therapist did stay through that incident, because if I had been in the building alone with that student with what all transpired during those 3 hours, it would not have been a good situation. So that student, actually, I do know what has happened, and that student, like I said, you know, there was a lot of homelessness issues and things going on, and Wilder worked with that family, with having a family navigator, to really help that family work towards having some housing stability, which then impacted other things, because the housing instability was causing a lot of problems with her job and just all sorts of different family dynamics. So they were able to really work with that family around those other issues in a way that unfortunately was not happening with the county for that particular family, because they were in between counties, and that's where things kind of unfortunately broke down.
Superintendent Lewandowski.
Madam Chair, Representative Adelson, I think another important point to share with the committee is research shows that if we integrate school-based mental health into our schools and our buildings, there's a 5 to 6-fold savings for public entities on a lifelong basis. So this is about a moral and educational question, but it's also an economic question. We can do better in all areas with this particular social problem that we're experiencing. And I think it's time that we look at different ways than we've used in the past to solve it.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to be asking Mr. Grainer some questions. But, you know, I really appreciated getting a chance to review all these kinds of experiences our children have. And I know, Mr. Grainer, you're a teacher and coach, or were, and I'm glad that you knew Dr. Perry and could have this interaction. But, you know, these things are happening probably in all of our communities to some extent. But, Dr. Grainer, to what extent would home visitation in the early years of children be beneficial? I think of the Jewish Family and Children's Services that comes out of St. Louis Park here in the Twin Cities area, and the fantastic modeling that those mostly women of all cultures do in a home with children. So to what extent would home visiting through that kind of organization or that kind of model be helpful to solve some of these problems?
Mr. Grainer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative.
Could you just pull up closer to the microphone?
Okay. As we often talk about the brain, we say the earlier the better. The more we can intervene early, the easier it is to change some of the hurtful things that have been done in a child's life, and to better organize the brain, and just to make, you know, life a chance to thrive in life better. So home visitation to me is crucial. Anything we can do to maintain consistency between what we're teaching at school. And by the way, we teach these same concepts to kids, mm-hmm. the same as we do to teachers and staff of all kinds. So we also would like to teach similar concepts to parents to empower them to know better about themselves and then to obviously know better about their children. So I think when we wrap all that together, we have a good chance. And the earlier intervention, the better. So I love the idea of the home visitation, the home education. I think it's crucial.
Representative Erickson, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Grainer, I really appreciated the fact that Dr. Perry did not refer to race or religion. I know there was one foster family that was Christian, but otherwise there was no emphasis on where these children came from in regard to race or religion, and I really appreciated that. So we could not separate, but look at all children. That's always important to me, that we don't separate out. But my next question, my last question to Madam Chair, thank you for indulging me. To what extent should teacher preparation programs be looking at more closely at brain development of our children, and then at how they would handle these trauma experiences that, you know, many children have in our classrooms?
Mr. Grainer.
Thank you. We're addressing that now because we do believe that teacher preparation is the next frontier for us. It is hard to often change the minds of people who have been entrenched in a certain, you know, belief system and experience. I'm one of those, so I'm not criticizing from outside in, believe me. That's where we're headed. And we have begun programs at a couple universities now that will allow them to be trained in this model as undergraduates in the education field. So, yeah, I was actually just got to go teach to Concordia teacher education students just last week. And it reminded me again, that's where we're headed. That's what we'd really love to do, because it's hard to change minds and change systems after someone has done something for a long time. We would rather have our young educators have this background now. Thank you. That's an excellent question.
Yeah, Representative Erickson, thank you so much for asking that question and about the Jewish Children Family Service Home Visit Program. When I spoke with Dr. Perry after his discussion, I kind of approached him about that. I've been an early quality early childhood advocate for a long time for early childhood education, and he did mention that all children would benefit from early childhood education. And I don't know if you want to add to that at all, and then I've got a few more member questions. Mr. Greiner.
Well, you know, as I said, we have, that might be the second frontier that we're becoming more involved in, is working with early childhood educators. And it really simply is for the fact that that is a more changeable, malleable,
yes,
and able to heal brain that we appreciate the early start. And in places where we've been successful with early childhood intervention, eliminates a whole host of problems by kindergarten and first grade, things they're not experiencing because kids have been essentially regulated and put in a better learning space at an earlier age.
So. Thank you. And I've got two more questions, and then maybe we'll make some quick comments about the books if people want to add in. I want to make sure that we get to Representative Moran's bill by about 10:45 or so. So, Representative Erdog.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers. I think it's a very valuable thing that you're doing to address the trauma that our students have. I appreciate, I think you've also mentioned stress and trauma that the teachers face, and I think that's something that needs to be looked at perhaps in more detail as well. But since this is a statewide problem, my question is, I noticed that the Department of Human Rights has identified 43 districts. And again, looking at it statewide, what percent of those 43 are in the 7-county metro area? Do you know that?
Superintendent Lewandowski, I don't know if you know about the Department of Human Rights study from a few years ago on the non-exclusionary discipline, but
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm certainly aware of it, but I do not have the statistic that you're asking for about how many are in the metro area.
Representative Erdahl, maybe we can get you those stats. I know it went as far up as Walker on some of the schools, but we can make sure that.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be interested in that.
Did you have a follow-up question at all? Okay. Representative Kunesh-Mateen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, presenters. This is a really important discussion. I myself am a teacher of 25 years, and I work in a district that probably could be case studies for many of you, and I wouldn't be surprised if some of our students came to your place of security. As I read the book, The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog, I could easily place students within those scenarios. And while I haven't had very much formal training around how to react or support these students, we kind of have learned between ourselves as teachers how to address a student's issue. One of the problems we have is being able to share their stories or share the data. And it would be important if we were able to do that so that we knew what were some of the things that these students were dealing with. But my question is sort of around, you talk about the mental health and the staff well-being. It's really hard to come to school every single day and have classes changing by the hour, and you're going to get a new group of students. You don't know what's going to trigger one student or two students or three students. And so my question to you is, how have you been able to care for your teachers and for your staff so that as they are struggling with this, as the trauma is affecting them and perhaps their personal life as well, how do you keep your staff strong and healthy mentally, socially, and psychologically?
Principal Allen or Superintendent Lewandowski, whoever would like.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would say it's a major challenge that we experience. One of the things that we have as part of our district mobile response team is respond to the staff's emotion after a major incident to help them at least get an initial opportunity to talk about the trauma they may have just had, for example, if they were assaulted. We also are talking about it more in our school district, a make it okay type of campaign. We've changed our employee assistant provider to one who's more sensitive to our needs and is more racially diverse. So we are coming at it from multiple viewpoints, but we see it play out with our staff on a regular basis. This fall we had an incident. I just happened to walk in the building and a student had assaulted one of our educational assistants. And she came to me in tears and said, I was the victim of domestic abuse. All I could see was that kid playing out in my mind as what I had experienced. So we all come to our workplaces with trauma that we have to understand, and we have to be able to understand what the kid's trauma is and make that work together in a way that moves us both forward. It's not a us-them kind of mentality. We're both in it together in this field.
I think Representative Kunesh-Bodine has a follow-up, but then we'll have Representative Sandstead, and then if folks want to chime in, this is a nice transition into the book. If you could, testifiers remain at the table in case we want to talk about the book, and then also how it's practically being put into practice in your district. Representative Kunesh-Bodine.
Thank you, and that was, I'm so glad to hear that you are taking care of your staff as well, because if we're not healthy and have those tools available, we can't really do the best for those students either. But sort of in line with what you were saying about the staff member that had been a victim of violence themselves, I have been reading more and more about epigenetics and how some of these traumas have literally changed our genetics generation by generation. And I'm wondering just really quick what your thoughts are on that and how you think that might play into not just our adults that are working with our students, but our students as well.
Superintendent Lewandowski, your principal on. I know your organization has also looked at this as well, but if you could be brief, and then we'll go to Representative Sandstead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the research that we have learned is that that fact is absolutely correct, and it plays out generationally in a way that we see operating in our schools. So again, the professional development that's needed for our staff includes that understanding of historical kind of trauma, mm-hmm. and what it means to generations that follow. I think perhaps that is one of the biggest things that we can teach our staff. I know this year I had my own learning experience where a paraprofessional, after I witnessed an exchange between a mom and her child that wasn't very pleasant, and he explained to me how he believed that was historical trauma playing out in the mother-child relationship, and it gave me a whole new way to look at that particular interaction. So it indeed is something that is part of our learning or what we need to learn.
Thank you. Representative Sandstead.
I'll be brief. Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the superintendent, I just want to say a very heartfelt thank you to you and to your staff for the tremendous work that you're doing. And my question for you is, are you experiencing a great amount of turnover in staff due to the situations that you're dealing with?
Superintendent Lewandowski.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I get asked that a lot, and my answer is we do experience a fairly significant turnover in our paraprofessional staff, and also to a lesser degree with our licensed staff, but I also balance it to say that staff who come and stay are in it for the long term. They're passionate about this work, about changing the lives of students and their families. So I believe part of the turnover could be improved if we had better training to give them some advanced background in what they're getting into. It's hard to describe. After only 4 days of new staff academy in our district, to walk into a classroom that's in Principal Allen's building, it's just simply not enough. And you need ongoing coaching after that as well. So that would be my response.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. And then, folks, if folks want to get on the list again to talk about the book or have any takeaways you'd like to mention, I did have one quick question, too, that kind of struck me about the book as I was reading it, too. Trauma seems to cut across all lines, social, economical, racial, and maybe, Mr. Grainer, you could talk a little bit about that, because I think sometimes we get a picture in our head of what kids are at risk, and sometimes you can't see in their head to see what kids are at risk.
Yeah, a lot of thoughts go through my head, but what I'd like to share is that if we took out the word trauma just for a second and talked about stress, it makes it universal to all of us. Mm-hmm. And the handling of life stressors is common to every person in this room, as it is to every child, as it is, and it is doesn't matter what our racial, what our race background is. It really doesn't matter what our age is. I think the stress and trauma probably adversely affects children even more than adults, but it affects us all. And so the understanding of what it is and how it kind of affects our operating system is, we feel, is a universal need. And that's why we do the work we do. Because we come together around this whole idea of life is all about surviving sometimes and thriving at other times. And we're all on that continuum somewhere. And in that, I think we find our empathy, because we're all there.
Thank you.
I don't know
Mr.
if I answered
Grainer.
That question at all.
You did. And I think where I'm getting with this, too, is that we are going to have a bill up that talks about our adverse childhood experiences and ACEs and trauma training, which is desperately needed too as well, because I think everybody, like you said, has stressors, but how your brain's been developed and how you can handle those stressors can be completely different among our students. And that's wherein lies where we need to do that extra work, making sure that students have the assets and the strength to withstand some of that. And some of the stories you had was in the book were building those kind of tools and assets. We had last year, we also had the Search Institute and Bar Center come in to talk about building assets in children and how to strengthen their resiliency, basically. And I think that was the most hopeful part of this book for me, was reading how we can still maybe turn that tide and help children build resiliency despite that the trauma and what's happened with their growing brain and others. Superintendent Lewandowski, what's up, Dad?
Madam Chair, I couldn't pass up just one more comment. We have an incredible asset in our educators and paraprofessionals in this field, and they're capable of providing dosing of relationships, as Dr. Perry would say, that has tremendous value. It doesn't necessarily all mean clinical mental health, but rather it can be the power of those relationships. And once educators understand how the brain functions and how trauma may be bringing something out, their relationship can be invaluable to the healing of that child. So we have a great opportunity here, but we have to get the professional development there to bring our staff along.
Thank you so much. And Representative Erickson, you had a follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I also wanted to thank all three presenters for your presentation today. I recall when Minnesota teachers became mandatory reporters. So my word of advice after reading and rereading this book that we were assigned is that we need to tread lightly and carefully as we pursue professional development if that becomes reality. Because I recall instances that were not accurate on my part when I took a look at students, my high school students, like on a Monday morning, especially girls. And, you know, I you've got to be careful that you don't invade their privacy and make a misdiagnosis. And I guess that would be my key word, that we teachers don't become diagnosers, because we're never going to have the expertise that a Dr. Perry has, or perhaps you have, Mr. Grainer, or I know that Ms. Lewandowski has over her years or her decades of experience. So, you know, let's tread lightly as we pursue professional development, because teachers can be put in precarious situations when they get involved either in mandatory reporting or, in this case, trauma-informed services. Thank you.
Anybody follow up to that? Principal Allen?
Chair, yes. You know, I can't speak to every setting, and I understand what you're saying about mandated reporting. When I think about the professional development, obviously we want to take into consideration that the bias that individuals may have about what they report and those types of things. But I don't think we're looking at that professional development as a diagnostic piece, but rather an understanding piece. Because if you don't understand how the brain works and you're working with a group of children all day, every day, there has to be an understanding of what is and what is not developmentally appropriate or for you to respond to as a teacher. And I think we're lacking that. I think that we have people that have best of intent but lack of knowledge, and there's developmental knowledge has come a long way for all of us. I mean, this is 20 years ago I got a master's degree in social work. If I had not done some additional learning since that 20 years, my understanding as a social worker and then becoming a principal would be totally different than what it is now today in 2020. That's what we're really talking about when we talk about professional development, because lots of teachers have lots of knowledge about instructional content, and you're working with children, and you need to have that understanding and depth of knowledge around what are they bringing into a classroom every day, which is different. Thank you.
Thank you, and I just want to thank you all again and echo statements here for all the work that you're doing with our kiddos and your switch from the school safety officers. I think that's great, and that you've had good success with that. But what strikes me is we have to remember you serve 11 member districts. These are all of our kids, and you take care of some of the most extreme cases because our individual districts can't. And you're also being asked to tackle a huge issue for our kids when they come in your door with a safety net, as you mentioned, that had a lot of holes in it. And we have this moral obligation to take care of these children because they all are all our kids, and we need to figure out up here how we can have your back. So thank you so much. And I'm going to move on to Representative Moran's bill. And thank you again for coming today. Representative Moran, thank you for coming to present House File 3556 for informational hearing. Because we are doing this at an informational hearing aspect, we'll have some member questions, but I am not going to be taking questions or comments from the audience at this time. This bill will be heard in full, or should probably be heard in full. I shouldn't speak for Chair Dabney, but it is in front of the Finance Committee. So will be more time for public testimony then. And you brought enough of the public with you. So, Representative Moran, proceed with your testimony. I know you have to leave by 11:15 when we're gaveling out, too. Yeah. So
good morning, Chair Joachim and Chair Dabney. Thank you for creating this opportunity for this bill to be heard before the committee members. I do think it's a very important issue, one, for teachers to have additional tools in their tool pockets, but I think it's also good information for us as legislators to know how trauma-informed policies and practice intersect with education. So I'm going to open up by saying I know you've heard about trauma-informed because we just had a long presentation here. And this is a term that's been part of like a therapy and psychological world for a while, but it has made its way to education. Being trauma-informed means having knowledge and awareness of the effects of trauma. This is obviously a very useful tool in therapy, but what it does, you're asking, what do you have to do with education? So trauma has the ability to affect almost every single aspect of a child's development by physically altering and wiring the child's brain. If so many of our students potentially have the wiring of their brain physically altered, then teachers need to be aware. A teacher's job is to help students' mind develop. But if something is altering the course of their typical development, then it becomes a significant factor in their education. The effect of trauma can manifest themselves in many, many ways. A few that are common is in the classrooms are a lack of focus, impulsivity, behavior problems, aggression, shutting down, manipulation, defiance, and even being perfection. I'm guessing that you've seen, I'm guessing that teachers have seen plenty of these examples in their own classroom. Trauma-informed education is essentially made up of two parts: understanding trauma and its effects, and then knowing how and what to do about them. It's one thing to recognize the defiance of this little first grade student as an effect of trauma, but it's a whole another thing to know how to handle that in a classroom. Research has shown that due to the effect of trauma on the brain, traditional discipline and the reward systems are ineffective. It's an ineffective way of managing negative behavior. So, you know, all those times that teachers have racked our brains and we as parents and others have racked our brains, consulted with our colleagues, or wasted huge amount of money on $100,000 stickers and awards to try to figure out how to get your students to change their behavior. And then, you know what? Nothing works. When teachers learn what trauma is, how it affects their students, and then how to implement trauma-informed practices, it completely changes everything. You could see fewer behavior problems, higher student engagement, and more academic achievements. Yes, that's right. That's what I said. I know it's almost sound too good to be true, but it's not. It takes work on the part of teachers, and sometimes it takes a lot of work, but the payoff can be extraordinary. It's not a curriculum that you can implement next week. It isn't a magical formula or technique. Trauma-informed education is about being a lifelong learner and making a commitment to helping the hard-to-reach students in your classroom. It's slow and a steady change, but over time, the impact is huge. It helps the teachers look at students, children, babies, youth, teens, and instead of saying, "What is wrong with them?" the teacher instead says, "What happened to this child?" or "What is happening to this child?" and respond accordingly to the tools they have been given through the trauma-informed training they partook in. And so I hear some probably better testifiers than I can ever be who are in the classroom who have done this work. And so, Madam Chair, if I can, that's a little bit of my testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Moran. Just state your name for the record and proceed.
Hi, I'm Lynn Thompson, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am super nervous. My people are with me here to help me feel a little calmer. But I'm very happy to be here and to share our story and support this bill. We're here representing Piedmont Elementary. We're a school from Duluth. We're from Duluth Public Schools. With us is our building principal, Beth Shermone, our social worker, Jess Bradley, Jacob Laurent, our dean of students, and Kathy Akrovic, who is a second grade classroom teacher. I am a fifth grade classroom teacher. We are a committee that's been responsible to implement some practices in our building using the grant funds we received from the National Education Association to support the Every Student Succeeds Act. And our journey began when our entire staff completed a comprehensive needs assessment with the help of Education Minnesota. It was a 123 question survey, and it focused on the needs of the students and the staff and what we saw as being the biggest, having the biggest impact on our students' success. And when we were done, the results were pretty clear. Poor student attendance and unmet mental health needs were identified as two huge contributing factors. We then broke the data down even further and started looking at things and found that of Duluth Public Schools, Piedmont Elementary was ranked third as reported on the Minnesota report card for having the highest inconsistent attendance. So it was pretty simple. The kids weren't coming to school enough, and if they're not in school, they aren't learning. So we started to look at, then we looked at our Minnesota, our MCA data, and in 2018, we had two-thirds of our grade three students who had missed 10 or more days that did not meet in reading, and of the same group, 53% didn't meet in math. So they weren't there, and they weren't meeting. Grade four, we saw similar data with 85% of our students who had missed 10 or more days not meeting in reading, and 71% not reading in math. So it was, you know, it was pretty clear kids need to be in school, and then once they're there, we need to be able to have them ready to learn. So we currently staff, we have a full-time regular education social worker, we have a 0.8 special education social worker, a full-time dean of students. We also have available in our school in Northwood, we have Northwood Children's Services, which offers intensive day treatment program and outpatient therapy services. And even with all of these support staff in place, it's still notable that our staff indicated that unmet mental health needs as a major factor affecting our kids' learning and overall performance. Once we received the 50-50 grant from the NEA, the task was to determine what to do with these funds. And so we began by sharing out the data with all of the staff at Piedmont. Data drives our decisions. And so we shared the data from the needs assessment, our attendance data, office discipline referrals, and suspensions. And then we began to implement some incentives to improve attendance and professional development that would support work with students who have experienced extreme trauma. For attendance, we created an attendance committee. We had an attendance-based welcome back open house, which included food, prizes, and flyers on the importance of regular school attendance. We implemented several attendance incentives school-wide, grade levels, classroom, and individual. Signage was created for outside and inside the building. Attendance flyers were shared with families and posted regularly on our social media and in-home communications. Our principal did work with the Regional Center of Excellence. We had an intern social worker who focused on meeting individually with the students with chronic attendance issues. And our professional learning time was spent by grade levels to focus on students with attendance concerns and ways to reach out to these families to encourage that regular attendance. Our trauma-informed professional development began with viewing of the Paper Tigers movie and a follow-up discussion on what we could learn from that. Additional staff development time and staff meetings were utilized to complete work around how well staff knew students school-wide and what trends and concerns could be identified from that information. Then how could we use that information in developing better connections with students? In addition, we sent a small group of staff to conferences that centered around trauma. Thank you.
State your name for the record and proceed.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jake Laurent. I'm the Dean of Students at Piedmont Elementary. First off, nice work, Lynn. We have seen momentous improvement in attendance this year, as well as significant decreases in office discipline referrals, ODRs, as well as exclusionary practices such as ISS and OSS. No change was made to our current PBIS discipline program, but our initiatives all fit nicely into the program. When comparing data from last year to this year, the results suggest that what we are doing is working. Here's our attendance data comparing last year to this year going through December. So last year through December of 2018, 182 of our students had missed 3 days or more. Currently this year, we went from 182 to 52 students who have missed 3 days or less. Last year in 2018, 23 students missed 7 days or more through December. Currently through December 2019, we have 6 students who have missed 7 days or less or more. Through December 2018, we had 14 students miss 10 days or more of school. And at this year, December, we are at 3. We also have shown significant changes in discipline data. If we're looking at our way that we track our major behaviors office discipline referrals, we've seen a decrease of 47% through December. Our out-of-school suspensions have decreased by 60% when compared to last year. In-school suspensions have decreased by 70%. We are getting our kids to school more. And when the kids are in school, we are doing a better job of keeping them in the classroom. And when they are in front of teachers more, they are going to learn. So that's a lot of data. To summarize it, attendance is improving, behavior is decreasing. Our staff have been rejuvenated by the work we have begun on trauma-informed practices. Clearly, our work is showing positive results, but we still have a very long ways to go. We are thankful to our union for their support through the grant. The grant helped us focus on what is having the biggest impact on students and what they need. We could not have done this important work without committed staff and our principal, Beth Shermone, who truly believes in this work and has supported us throughout. Our grant money is gone, but there's more work to do. The money this bill would provide could allow us to continue our work, to continue to see the improvements in attendance, to continue to see the decreases in behavior and how we manage that behavior in a positive, reconstructive way that heals harm. At Piedmont, we are a community. We're a family. We go through this every day together. And we're stronger for it. We have each other's backs. It's important that all of our people receive trauma-informed training. When we say all people, we mean all people, not just teachers. We need our paras who have more student contact time than any other staff member and who receive zero training through our district to be trained in this. They are working with our most tough children. We believe that every adult in our building contributes to creating a place where children can feel safe, welcome, and loved. Educating students has become a profession that is far more than teaching the content areas. Students have to be present, physically, mentally, and emotionally. And we have to be able to help them in all these things. School is so much beyond academics. We have shown you that trauma-informed work has helped us reduce disparities. We hope you can support this bill so we can better continue this work. From Piedmont Elementary in Duluth, we thank you for your time.
Thank you for coming all the way down here. And I'm sorry, I keep watching the time because I know Representative Moran has to be somewhere, but you really are hands-on using a community-based solution to tackle the opportunity gap, and I want to thank you. Representative Erickson had a quick question. Is it for this testifier?
Because I know I want to make sure we stay. I just wondered, was Duluth identified by human rights as one of those?
Correct.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Moran, go ahead and do whatever you need to do so we can make you get out, make sure you get out of here in time.
So, Madam Chair and members, so all I can, you know, would just like to share with you is that when trauma-informed practices are learned, when teachers are given the training, and I agree that in my mind it should be from the janitor to the principal, in every school building, there should be training in trauma-informed practices. that we begin to better understand children and how the brain, how the trauma impacts brain and brain development and the neurons and synapses that are not, you know, doing what they need to do to allow kids to come to school in their full self. But it also allow teachers and other people in the building to begin to look at children and their families through a different lens. And we become more empathetic to how we look at solutions and wraparound services. So my hope is that we can look at this as a promising practice or evidence-based practice that we can see that will reduce the disparities that we see, the educational disparities that we see happening around our state. And I do ask for your support in working towards that end.
Yes, and I think you, did you have, I have on here Richardson Elementary and Ravensdale Schools too, to testify. Did you want them to come up? Or
Richard Elementary? Yes, we have some really good data also.
Okay. Just state your name for a record and please keep it brief. We'll be done here in about 5 minutes or so. And I see Dr. Jenkins in the audience too, and I know he probably wanted to add something. Go ahead, state your name for the record and proceed.
All right, thank you very much, Chair and members of the committee, for this time. My name is Jonathan Gavin, and I'm the Check and Connect Program Specialist and Behavior Intervention Specialist at Richardson Elementary. This is Jenna Willemark, our school social worker. The students of our school come from very different walks of life. The population of our school is very diverse, racially and socioeconomically. With having a diverse population, some of our students have hardships in their lives. About 5% of our population are identified to be experiencing homelessness, including those doubled up with other family members. Nearly 70% of our school population qualify for free and reduced lunch and breakfast. For some of our students, this is the only access of food that they have because they don't have enough at home. Our students are sometimes witnesses to violence in their neighborhoods and also their own homes. They're exposed to substance abuse from home and see the effects it has on their family members. For some of their family members, they are dealing with their own mental illnesses. With all of these hardships and obstacles our students witness and face, it traumatizes them, and they yearn to have someone help them through it. Children facing traumatic stressors are disturbingly a common occurrence in a silent epidemic. They are at such a vulnerable state, unable to fend for themselves. Trauma can have a devastating effect on a child. It can run a gamut of problems on a child's foundational neurological and physical development.
And Madam Chair, again, my name is Jenna Willemark, and I am the school social worker at Richardson. So over the years, Richardson has incorporated different interventions and programs to help our students and families. We've been on a journey for the last couple of years towards becoming more trauma-informed and to incorporate restorative practices into our work with families. Our staff has been trained in both of these practices so that we can really be sensitive to each student's unique needs and see each student as wanting to do well. Recently, John and I did a professional development training on trauma and the effects that it has on our students. And we are continually having training on restorative practices and circles, not only for our teachers, but also for all of our support staff and our bus drivers. These circles give students a chance to voice their feelings to each other and to other staff. And instead of looking at, you know, just this as a problem or just a situation, we look at why did this happen and try to work together with students to work through it. We have a number of different circles happening every day, along with a program called Check and Connect, with which John runs and manages. His current caseload is 21 students, with more being added every day. We also have an on-site school-link therapist named Lindsay Sachs, who has a current caseload of 21 students. However, she is full, and we have many more students that are in need of mental health services. We also offer a variety of food support programs to help with some of the basic needs of our families. I am lucky enough to be at Richardson full-time this year, as our district has invested in having full-time school social workers in every building, which has helped immensely. I'm really able to better serve our students and our families. However, I am still full to the brim with students and with families to work with. So with more support, we would be even better able to serve our families.
Training.
Sorry. I was just going to say, if, I don't know if Dr. Jenkins has anything to add. We only have about two more minutes. But did you, Mr. Bradley, did you have something else to quick say? You mentioned training. Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Lyrent, did you have something else to add on training? Or
I'm saying the wrong one. Mr. Gavin, did you have something else to add? I'm sorry.
Yeah, if I could just reference some of the data that we have here just to share it with you.
Yes.
Training and support are starting to make a difference of our students and staff, especially our behavior referrals and suspension data. If you want to look at the handout that we have. Overall, our behavior referrals through the end of January are down 32% from 2 years ago, and the behavior referrals for our students of color are down 37%. Just 2 years ago, we had 13 out-of-school suspensions between September and the end of January, and then this year, we have zero. In each referral, we try to think of what's logical consequence for that student. We have found that consequences don't fix the behavior. Working with the student and realizing the why has tremendously helped. Richardson staff really try to see each student for the uniqueness, get to know our students through relationship building, and try to incorporate interventions to help them become successful.
Thank you, Mr. Gavin. I'm so sorry I got your name wrong. I have so many names in front of me.
No worries. So thank you.
The statistics look amazing. Thank you for sharing. And I'm sure people might be able to ask you offline about that when we wrap up here. Dr. Jenkins, would you like to quick add anything?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will cut down this 2 hours to a minute, okay? this is a topic I'm very passionate about. And the last time I was here reporting out on that trauma-informed practices and what's going on with trauma in our community, I've had an opportunity to go to many professional developments about it. And what I would have to say, many of the things that I could have said, I would have said, Dr. Lewandowski did a fabulous job, I think, of explaining it. And I'd also like to thank my colleagues for what they've shared. So get into my comments really quick in terms of we're doing many things in Robbinsdale area schools as we brought forth Dr. Chanel Miles, nationally known as well, and she came in and talked about trauma-informed practices, not only with students, but with adults. And during the professional development, many of the adults began to shed tears because they too had been impacted. And this is real. When we start talking about what's going on with the disproportionality, we're one of those districts that's also been identified prior to my arrival based upon that study that was done. And we see these practices of trauma, the ACEs characteristics playing out in the students and the adults alike. And I think that this is really critical that we're taking a serious look statewide. It doesn't necessarily matter if you're coming from the metro or if you're coming from the core city or rural. Trauma is across the board, and it is dealing seriously with how we are beginning to respond from a neurological standpoint. And I think that we need to make sure that we're putting forth the consistent dollars. I appreciate the one-time offer. But at the same time, this is a part of the problem with trauma. Students begin to see things as eventful. They start, they stop, they start, they stop. We have to step up and do a cross-agency, county, the state, and the districts working together to be able to fulfill the needs of our students, as we know that it's many needs. And I'll stop and allow my colleague to share his points there. But when you get ready for the other hour and 59 minutes, I'd be happy to share.
Thank you. I know Representative Dabney, Chair Dabney, had a quick question.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And have Mr. Eichhoff come up if
not
he wants
yet.
To.
So to either of the staff from Richardson, there are organizations in the state who are opposed to this sort of intervention and whose argument will be, I know how you got to less office referrals. You told teachers, don't you dare refer any student to the office. And the outcome of these sort of interventions is chaos in the classroom, ungovernable, unfit learning conditions. How's things at Richardson?
Thank you, Chair. Okay. Thank you. I've been there for about 9 years now, and so I've seen it grown over time through those 9 years. And I got to tell you, Richardson, to me, is an amazing place. I see teachers working really hard with each student that they have in their classroom and really trying to, as I talked about, getting to the why is the problem happening, what is happening, what is that situation. And I think since, you know, starting restorative justice and restorative practices, it's really getting to having those circles and having those difficult conversations if there's something going on in the classroom. And they're able to really kind of talk and grow together in relationship building. So what I've seen, it's been going really well.
Representative Moran, I know you have to leave. I have one of your co-authors here that can sit in if people still have more questions, but did you have a closing comment?
I do.
In response to Chair Dabney, I think when we create policies that say we shouldn't suspend kids or leave them in the classroom without giving teachers extra tools in their tool pocket, we may get a classroom that is full of chaos. You know, trauma-informed practices is a learn, something you have to learn to know how to do, to even to manage your classroom and to manage the building. And so I don't know what happened in those circumstances or if that was happened without giving teachers and others the tools that they need to be more effective in the classroom. But I think what we can say that those who are utilizing a trauma-informed practice, you see the results you need to see to change the difference, not only in suspension rates, but kids' behaviors themselves.
Thank you, Representative Moran. And I have Representative Hassan can take your place in case people have a few more questions, and then we'll wrap up here in like 2 minutes. So does anybody have
and Madam Chair, let me just say, this is not just about the students, neither. It is about secondary trauma that sometimes the teachers will carry on.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Members, does anybody else have some quick questions for the testifiers or any of the statistics? We're going to wrap up here in 5 minutes. Any Representative Sandel, did you have a, you look like you had a question. Anybody? Well, I think we're done. I just wanted to make sure in case people had questions that we had an author up there. Actually, we do have a quorum. I'm going to quickly move the minutes from last meeting. So we have the minutes from Wednesday, February 19th before us. Is there... anybody that, is there a motion to approve the minutes?
I would move that, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Kunesh Pudin moves the minutes to approve the minutes from Wednesday, February 19th. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed? The motion prevailed. The minutes for February 19th are approved. And members will be back at a regular time tomorrow. Everybody have a great day. Meeting adjourned.